Well, good morning, everyone. If we could get started. Good morning. Welcome. I'm Jim Danko. Welcome to Butler University. Welcome to our Schrott Center. If you haven't been here before, we've been quite fortunate to have this particular venue over the last 4 or 5 years, a nice companion to Clues, which I'm sure many of you know next door, which is quite a bit larger. But this is a great opportunity for us to host the BioCrossroads Frameworks event. And like many of you, I'm looking forward to the discussions here about the life sciences startup, Eli Lilly, and the company's acquisition of CoLucid. In my years here as a Hoosier, I've really been impressed by the continued growth of our life sciences industry. I applaud you and our business and community leaders for efforts in making Indianapolis and Indiana a center of innovation and entrepreneurial thinking, not only in the sciences, but across many industries. Here at Butler, we're working, like many of you, to put Indiana in a brain gain situation. More than half of our students right now are from out of state. We're attracting highly qualified, well-prepared students to Indiana, and our goal is that they will find work and make a meaningful impact right here in our region and state. Over the past several years, applications to Butler have nearly tripled. I know that in 2010, we had about 6,500 applications. Right now, we're above 15,000, and the year continues. So our application and enrollment growth has been considerable, and particularly in our Lacey School of Business and in our Natural Sciences program. In just the past 5 years, applications to the Lacey School of Business have grown by 48%. And to the natural sciences and math programs by approximately 60%. I remember my vice president of admissions telling me a couple years ago that they had, at that point in the year was still going, over 1,000 applications to our biology program that had about 100 seats. So that gives you a little bit of insight into what's happening here at Butler in those particular areas. We really are, when I think about our undergraduate education in sciences, we work hard to provide our students opportunities to participate in research and to connect the theory that they're hearing in the classroom with practice. We challenge our students to become citizen scientists, working on a range of projects that benefit our local and global communities, from small-scale urban farming to health outreach and vaccination education. I am very proud of the fact that our undergraduates regularly present their research at national conferences and publish in peer-reviewed academic and research journals alongside graduate students and faculty from other top universities. 43% of Butler seniors reported that they had participated in undergraduate research with a faculty member, compared to 36% at peer institutions and only 19% at other Carnegie classification institutions. Currently, as Butler is working towards a comprehensive fundraising campaign, our largest target area is in the sciences. We have a plan to spend over $90 million to turn what is right now our main science building, Gallahue Hall, as the what you might have noticed across the way here, some rather large concrete pillars emerging out of the ground. That's where our new Lacey School of Business is going to be located. So we're moving. As we move out of Holcomb, which adjoins our sciences, that building is going to be renovated and converted to sciences as well. So we're making a major investment in our campus to house the sciences and to make sure that we have up-to-date facilities on our campus. So though quite a heavy investment right now in the business and the sciences. In the process of doing that, I'm also pleased to say that our faculty and staff have visited companies like Lilly and Roche to look at their labs and to see what's currently happening out there and best practices and lab design to make sure that we're bringing that back into our university and making sure that our faculty and students have access to contemporary and current facilities. A number of our faculty, our professors, have done sabbaticals at Lilly and Dow AgroSciences, among other places. So we are heavily involved in trying to bring the practice of business and sciences into our classroom and better preparing our students. Our hope at Butler is to graduate students who go on to leadership careers of purpose. And on that topic, it is my pleasure to cite David Johnson as one of those individuals. David, as most of you know, is both president and CEO of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership and president and CEO of CICP's BioCrossroads Life Sciences Initiative. Through his work at BioCrossroads, David has been responsible for raising over $350 million in philanthropic, corporate, and venture capital funding. David also has been outspoken about the need to stop the brain drain in science, engineering, and IT. He has rightly said that we must address the situation with aggressive efforts to help employers fill thousands of high-paying jobs and keep the state competitive. David said, we must redouble our efforts to generate many more technology-intensive, skill-demanding jobs in leading Indiana sectors like life sciences and healthcare, energy and logistics, and defense and advanced manufacturing that hold the highest promise of reducing our disturbing downward slide of per capita income compared to other states. David, in addition to being a close friend, is an honors graduate of Harvard University, Harvard Law School, and Oxford University, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar. Please join me in a warm welcome for David Johnson.
Jim, thank you very much. Delighted to be here today. Apologies to all of you for my voice. I'm suffering from a 40-year cold, but I'm no longer contagious, and I'm at a great distance from all of you as well. This is spectacular for a whole lot of reasons. First, just this facility and the opportunity to be here with Jim Danko and colleagues at Butler. And I think, as you all know, this is the beginning of a new chapter for our framework sessions, which we'll be doing at Butler going forward. And we're very pleased to do that. It's going to be some great programming, and it's a wonderful location to be able to do it in. And we're just very grateful, Jim, to you for hosting us here and giving us the run of these wonderful facilities. We have a story for you today. And unlike, I run the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership as well as the BioCrossroads Initiative, and CICP includes four other technology-intensive initiatives, as well as the Ascend Workforce and Talent Initiative, of which Butler is a new and key member. And the initiatives are different. They're all focused on innovation. They're all focused on growth. They're all focused on startups. But when I look at what happens with my colleagues at TechPoint and the development of some of their companies and startups, they always seem to me like they happen overnight. The tech companies get started, someone has a really good idea, they put it together, they learn how to move it quickly, they get some early key investment, they have a novel approach to business, not so much worry about intellectual property as just being first in the market and making something happen. And time after time after time here in this community, we've been successful in scaling, particularly around business-to-business marketing software companies. We're really good at it, and we have a number of people here who are, and thank heavens that they are here and doing what they're doing, and they put a real buzz and excitement to what goes on. The life sciences innovation space is equally robust, and in fact, in many ways, it has an especially deep base of opportunity because there's so much terrific research, development, and innovation that goes on here in our research universities, our big companies, our startup entrepreneurs. This is one of the best places in the country to have an idea for a life sciences product or service and then try to figure out what to make happen with it. But it can take a while. And the story we're going to talk to you about this morning will illustrate that to you in spades. And it takes a while both because the science is really hard. To make something work in this sector, to make the best stuff work in this sector, you usually start out with a novel theory of something that might work better than something that's in the market. You hope you're right. You bring that discovery into the laboratory. You start to work with it. You see if it can actually be put in a commercial form. Very importantly, you then have to see if it kills anybody or any animals in the process. Then you have to decide if it really is effective and if it works. And then you have to run through a whole series, multi-year, very expensive trials to actually be sure that it is worthy of being put into the marketplace as a regulated but effective therapeutic for whatever the disease is that people are seeking to treat. And at any given time in our society, there's only so many of these shots you can try to take and so many things you can try to do because the process is so expensive. Darren Carroll's colleague, David Ricks, the new CEO at Lilly, likens the development of a new drug or a new therapeutic to having to develop a whole new healthcare system around each candidate to try to figure out if it works or not. And that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of talent. It takes a lot of people. And it often usually occurs in many places at once, because our companies tend to be not based on revenues, but tend to be based on raising capital to get through this clinical process. And so they are very capital intensive, fundraising intensive, regulatory and clinical trial intensive, which means that you are where all of those opportunities take place for you. And so most of our companies that we work with, actually the science may be here, the leadership may be here, the regulatory assets may be somewhere else, some of the investors may be somewhere else. It is challenging for us sometimes to say whether it's a Indiana company, a Boston company, a San Diego company, because by the end of the day, all of those places are usually involved in the development of the most promising assets. You're going to hear a story like that today of what is an awesome thing that started here, is back here. It started in the first part of 2006, as back in the day when the Indianapolis Star had a business section and it had its own dedicated business section and it had a front page for it. It was the entire front page of the business section. And it was the story of the largest biotechnology deal that had ever been done in Indiana by far, a $16.5 million deal involving a novel approach that Bob Crossroads had helped to put together by organizing a venture capital fund, a big, what's called a fund of funds, which means that the fund itself invests in other venture capitalists who come in and look for the right things to invest in themselves. And this was an opportunity so large that of the six venture capital firms that were participating in our Indiana Future Fund at that time, three of them came together, led by Art Pappas at A.M. Pappas and Associates, and you're going to hear from Art in just a moment, too, but also ably represented here in Indiana by John Bernard and Pearl Street, who you're also going to hear from, and another colleague of ours, Triathlon Medical Ventures, as well as yet another national firm, Domain, which came together to work with Lilly, won a competitive auction, and got as the prize an asset that was really, really interesting. And we're going to hear about that today. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the science, but you should know at least what Colucid is. Colucid was developed within Lilly, as Lilly is very good at central nervous system and pain disorders. This is the company that brought us Zyprexa and Prozac and Strattera and a number of things having to do with cognition and cardiovascular and mental issues as well. And Colucid was a candidate somewhere within that grouping that at the time that Lilly was thinking about what it was going to prioritize for development, again, this is early 2006, was not at the top of the queue for further commercialization, even though it looked promising. And so, as Lilly sometimes does, they decided this was a molecule to be out-licensed. But for the first time ever, we actually had a community here and a venture capital ability here, which we had not had before, thanks to the Indiana Future Fund, to be able to say, hey, we'd like a shot at that. And so the Indiana Future Fund came together, again, led by Art, as with his participation in that fund, and John Bernard, and said, we would like to make that happen. And they spent a lot of time in discussions, negotiations with Lilly, looking at this novel therapeutic. And it was a novel therapeutic to treat migraine headaches, which is a really hard thing to treat. And there hadn't been a new therapeutic in the marketplace for migraines and for people who suffer for them. This is after you have the headache, this makes it go away. This doesn't just prevent it, it actually treats it. There hadn't been a new treatment for migraines for years, probably 10 or 15 years at that point. And it was an area, because of the severity of the disease and the disorder, many people who suffer from migraines also have other cardiovascular implications, and there were a number of different drugs on the market at the time, still are, for migraines that people with cardiovascular challenges can't take. And so it was truly an unmet medical need, but again, at the time, it was not necessarily the same priority for Lilly, and you'll hear more about that today, as some of the other things that they were looking at, but a good candidate for development. And so our group raised their hand and signed on to take Colucid out for development, to take it through the clinical process, and hopefully someday, like Pinocchio, it would grow up to be a boy, it would grow up to become a company, and it would be something that would yield tremendous return for the investors and tremendous success for the community and result, ideally, in a new company. That was 11 years ago. And at the beginning of 2017, not too long actually after Dave Ricks took over as a CEO at the new CEO at Lilly, there was another headline that announced that Lilly was buying as a strategic acquisition, this new company that it would use as an anchor for its pain management portfolio called Colucid. And it was buying that company for the price of almost $1 billion, which isn't all that much money in some respects, but you know, it's also a lot of money. And it was not only buying this asset, but again, it was going to put it to work as a key driver for a new component of what Lilly sells in the marketplace. So it was going to not only result in making some people in Indiana wealthy, it was going to result in keeping some people in Indiana employed. It was going to put new jobs into the marketplace, new taxpayers into the state's tax payrolls. It's awesome. It's like hitting all the things you can possibly want to do in the development of one of these companies. But it took 11 years, and it took some remarkable people and some remarkable stamina, some terrific risk-taking, a lot of additional investment, both by the venture marketplace and also ultimately by the public marketplace when it went public. And so our purpose for you today, we have some wonderful people to tell you this story. And interestingly, this story has never been put together. So we knew a lot about the front end. We obviously knew a whole lot about the front end. We knew about how it got launched. Until I was talking to Jim Danko at a reception a year ago, I had never met Tom Mathers. I certainly knew who he was, and I knew what he had done with Colucid. But we'd never had the chance to sort of say, here's how it started, here's why it started, here's what it took, and then here's what happened with it. And so that's our purpose for you today. And finally, and we hope you have a lot of questions about this, this is not a one-shot wonder. This is not something that cannot happen and should not happen over and over and over again if we are prepared as a community and as a region and as a state to understand what we have here and the promise of what we have here and our ability to do really huge things with it if we have the determination to make it work and if we can find the talent, the money, and the time to be sure that we get the best stuff into the system and out the door. So that's our purpose this morning, and let me bring up four people who can tell this story and will tell this story from a variety of different viewpoints. First, I want to introduce my colleague, Darren Carroll. And guys, if you can just come up and we can start to take seats here. My colleague, Darren Carroll. Darren is the Senior Vice President of Business Development at Eli Lilly and Company. Darren is the guy who did the deal on the acquisition of Colucid. Darren is also the chair of BioCrossroads and has been very involved in every step of the way. Darren is also the chairman of the advisory board of the Indiana Future Fund, which was the group, again, that worked with Art Pappas and John Bernard and others in the beginning to capitalize Colucid. So Darren knows this story from both ends. He, like me, was there in the beginning, and we're still here. Another person who has just joined us on the stage is our colleague John Bernard. John Bernard was also at Eli Lilly and Company, took the early retirement package at an earlier day, similar to some of the packages that are being offered today, and went out and really became the community's really first serial entrepreneur in the life sciences area. John was the first guy who said, it can be done here, it should be done here, and I'm going to do it here. And in coming together for the Indiana Future Fund, John put together Pearl Street Venture Partners, became a venture capitalist, and found his way into the Colucid deal, and he will tell you where the story goes from there. Art Pappas, A.M. Pappas & Associates, is a colleague of ours we have worked with since the very beginning. Art was somebody who made putting the Indiana Future Fund together really worthwhile. He's based in North Carolina, in Research Triangle in North Carolina. He has a pharma background as well, came out of Glaxo, has been very involved in the startup of the contract research industry, and Art has been doing this for a while on the venture capital side, has had a fund that has always been interested not only in North Carolina regional development, but in other regions across the United States that are promising as well. And again, fortunately for us, Art identified central Indiana and Indiana itself as one of those regions early on. And so Art was one of the early signers on to the Indiana Future Fund. And then finally, we have Tom Mathers. And the first time I ever heard, I didn't meet Tom Mathers until right now, but I heard Tom Mathers on an analyst call not long after Labor Day, a year and a half ago, when he was reporting the exciting results of what Colucid was doing in its clinical trials process, and it was clear some big things were going to happen. This is the guy that really took the company all the way through, that made it work, that made it into a tremendous commercial success, building on the efforts of others, but really knowing what to do to actually make it and bring it home. And so Tom is going to give us the final part of this story here today, and then we're going to open it up for questions for you. So let's go ahead and start this. Hope my microphone's working. It is. Guys, I'll take a chair, and I'm going to sit far enough away from you that no one gets too worried about it. So, Darren, let's start this conversation.
Sure.
So you were at Lilly at the time, not in your current role, of course, but you were at Lilly at the time that this whole thing got underway. And one question that's come up early on when the sale of Colucid to Lilly last year came up was, why did you let it go in the first place? And how does a decision like that get made within a company like Lilly?
Yeah, it's a great question. The whole story starts actually with the story of serotonin, because this is fundamentally a science story, right? Because this is a life science company. So serotonin is, as many of you know, I'm sure not all of you though will know, is the receptor in the body that is associated with a lot of things. I'm going to leave all those things off and say it's associated with the modern Lilly. Because Lilly was one of a number of companies exploring serotonin receptors. We developed a drug that was known internally by its scientific name. Fluoxetine hydrochloride is known a bit more popularly as Prozac. That started a wave of innovation around a number of subtypes of the serotonin receptor that went on at Lilly for actually about 20 years. We became really the gold standard in research around all the serotonin complex, including a subtype called 5-HT1F. That happens to be the serotonin receptor subtype that is associated with lasmiditan, this drug. Okay. As time went on, however, what we started to realize was that at least as far as we were able to go with it, we had taken that scientific research as far as strategically we were prepared to take it. We knew, for example, that 5-HT1F was an approach that could be used in pain, various kinds of pain, but for us, strategically, pain was just not on strategy at the time. So in 2005, we undertook a strategic review of all the research that we were doing, and we asked ourselves, what are the areas that we should be in? Now, I can tell you, leaving serotonin was a really hard thing, right? I mean, it's, you know, leaving a great love, if you will. Scientifically, it was a great love. But it was a very disciplined decision to say, you know, we're not really in the pain space. It's not an area that we are experts in. Strategically, this molecule, which came off of that research program, is targeted at pain, but we're probably not the right company to develop it. And in particular, it's the type of pain that we thought it was most likely to have its greatest effect in, migraine pain, was an area where strategically in 2005, the year before this actual story began, we decided, you know, if we're ever going to get into pain, that wouldn't be the area. Now fast forward a good while, maybe about 5, 6, 7 years, we have another drug called Cymbalta. Cymbalta became ultimately the greatest selling drug in the history of Lilly. It too actually had some application in pain. We kind of fell into the pain space. We did develop Cymbalta for certain kinds of pain, and we found that we were actually pretty good at it. That drug went off patent. We get a call from our friends, I use the air quotes, at Pfizer. I say friends because we actually are collaborating with them really well right now, but we've competed against them for years. Pfizer asked us to work with them on another drug called tanezumab, this one, a nerve growth factor inhibitor, for pain. And they said, I said, honestly, why are you calling us? Because we compete all the time. They said, you know, you guys did so great a job competing against us in the pain space with Cymbalta. We want to work with you for once out of every 100 years or so. And so we created a collaboration. So in 2013, we found ourselves back in the pain space, right? Now, over that whole time, lasmiditan was being developed outside of our shop, right? But we weren't in the pain space that whole time. We were watching, but we weren't in it. So Cymbalta kind of brought us back in. Tanezumab brought us back in a big way. And then we bought back another drug I'll talk about maybe later called galcanezumab, also in the migraine space. And before you knew it, all of a sudden, a drug that was being developed totally outside of our doors, if you will, of our lab, for over a decade, became directly on strategy. So it was completely off strategy when we started. By the time we acquired it, it was very much on strategy, honestly, somewhat due to accidents of history. So that's why it made sense for us strategically to step away. It's also why it made a ton of sense afterwards, you know, once, you know, Tom and the Calusa team, you know, led by, you know, the financial leadership of the two folks sitting to my immediate left, after they did all that work, it made a lot of sense for us to step back in. But it only made sense for us to step back in at that time. So that's the long strategic arc for Lilly. That's an over 10-year story for us.
So one thing that changed a lot during that period, too, when and I think this was in that front page story in 2006, the working model that some people had, at least at that time, was, well, this will be the next Lilly. In other words, we were taking this molecule, you were going to build a whole pharmaceutical company out of it. Obviously, that's not what happens anywhere today. I can't think of a single case in which a new Lilly or Pfizer or anything remotely approaching it has been built, or frankly, in my view, will be built. But over that period of time, Lilly became, in some ways, the market for Lilly and other large pharmaceutical companies became the market for innovation to sort of take it the next step going forward. And so, as you suggest, you guys were watching it. I'm mindful of the fact that you and Tom spent quite a bit of time negotiating for the outcome here. But I guess what I'm getting at here is, the outcome, the price, all of that, would Lilly have been better off to keep it internally, or is this, did this really turn out to be a good deal, even from the cost standpoint?
Yeah, this was a good deal. I'll tell you why. And it actually didn't have to do so much with how much we overpaid for it. This is kind of our running joke.
I'm sensitive to it.
It's not so much how much we paid for it, so much as it is what would we have done with the money that it took to develop this, right? So it's not just that we paid for it. Actually, these guys invested in it over a very long, and others invested in it, and the public market invested in it as well over a very long time. Tom was able to get Calusa public, right? So the public market put money into this. While all that was happening, we were investing in other medicines, right? Investigational compounds. Mm-hmm. Compounds called like Taltz and Trulicity, which are now the two fastest growing compounds in our pipeline today, right? So the other story for us is while all this was happening, Lilly starting in roughly 2010 or so, so roughly through the halfway mark of this, Lilly went through this period of patent expiry. So we had about a 4.5-5 year period where the patents expired on a large number of our molecules, right? Enough molecules, in fact, to cover 40% of our revenues, right? So at that time, we decided we were doubling down on innovation, right? So, and we did. It was a risky strategy, one that has paid off. So we invested heavily in the development of other molecules like Taltz, like Trulicity, and our shareholders are now really getting the benefit of that. Mm-hmm. What that did, however, was that created real scarcity for research dollars within Lilly, right? So while it was a strategic decision to put Lasmiditan outside of Lilly, if it had been in our pipeline at that time, it would have been competing with some pretty incredible medicines that were also nudging aside. They were kind of muscling aside, if you will, other molecules that were in our pipeline at that time. So it's not obvious to me anyway that Lasmiditan would have made it all the way to the finish line in our hands, right? So it wasn't so much how much we paid, it's really whether we would actually have done that, and I'm not sure we would have.
And Darren, just to spotlight that for just a moment, when you say making it all the way to the finish line, it's not just a go, no-go decision at the beginning of the development of this process. You're assessing, as do VCs building a company, every step of the way, is this worth it to continue?
That's right.
I have this new barrier. Is it worth it trying to overcome that or not?
That's right. Because, you know, first of all, you are putting this medicine into human beings. And we always are thinking about, first of all, what is the safety profile of this?
Right.
Are the benefits of this investigational compound likely to outweigh any adverse effects that might be associated with taking it? Right. So there's no drug that has ever been invented that is completely safe, right? So there are always some safety issues that have to be taken into account. That's one of the issues that we ask ourselves. And the next is, compared to all the other things that we can invest in, what's the unmet medical need here, right? Are we going to be able to present some, you know, really important solutions for big unmet medical need with the next dollar, with the next million, with the next 100 million? Those are very imperfect decisions, okay? I mean, I don't want to suggest to you we get them all right. We get a lot of them wrong, right? On balance, we get a lot more of them right than we do wrong. That's why we're 142 years old. But we know we make mistakes. And sometimes they're not even mistakes, but, you know, at the time we make them, right decision. At the time we made the lasmiditan decision, it was the lowest ranked molecule in our portfolio based on the data that we had, right? But it goes to show you how tough this business is, right? That you make a decision based on the best data you have, and you say, boy, strategically, it's not where we're at, and this won't compete as well, and it turns into what will ultimately be, I believe, a very important medicine for patients suffering from migraine. Ultimately, that's what the story is about, right? Ultimately, this story is about delivering a medicine to patients who really need it, because it turns out that migraine is a very serious problem for a lot of people in our society. You know, Tom will tell you the size of the problem when he talks about this, but it's important. And that is what we're looking at, right? All those decisions, those investment decisions are, how can we bring the greatest benefit to the greatest number of people with the who are, at the moment, have the greatest amount of suffering, mm-hmm. right?
So one question I have to ask you before I bring John into this conversation. Can this happen again? Are there, this sounds like a strategy that made sense for Lilly to do with this molecule. Could we see more of this type of activity here?
Probably. You know, part of the reason this happens is because science is really badly behaved, right? Science doesn't sort of make itself amenable, to industrial processes, even though we actually have to make it amenable to industrial processes. So we have to make decisions at a certain point in time. We have to make them with very imperfect information, and we have to make strategic decisions knowing that we may have new information about a strategy. Mm-hmm. When we made the decision, for example, on pain strategy 12 years ago, almost 13 now, candidly, if you were to look at the files, and I have looked at them, if you look at the files of the data that was available to us at the time in 2005, not going in pain was a smart decision. Going back into pain 10 years later was a smart decision. The world changed. So we're going to see that again. Our lab is going to find periods where it's more productive than we could possibly invest in. And we're going to make tough strategic decisions using the best information we can, knowing that some of those molecules that go outside could be very, very valuable mm-hmm. molecules. Mm-hmm. But we can't. We don't have, our crystal ball is cracked mm-hmm. And a little cloudy. So we make the best decisions we can with the best information we have.
But we're all hoping they are valuable molecules. Yeah. That's great. So John, you found yourself in this. How did you find yourself in the Indiana Future Fund, and then how did you find yourself in the Clucid investment?
Well, you know, as David knows, we had kind of this sleepy, laid-back consulting firm after I took early retirement from Lilly. And there were about five of us. We've been doing work with small companies and process reengineering. And then I started getting some very senior Lilly people calling me and wanting to go to lunch and saying, I have a feeling you're having more fun than I'm having. Do you have room for one more? Well, all of a sudden, we had nine more people that had real strong Lilly experience from a variety of functions, and we changed our focus more to life science consulting. And then this fellow named Mike Arpey knocked on the door, who I'd never met, never heard of, and he was is it Credit Suisse?
At the time, yes, that's right.
And he said, I noticed you didn't apply for funds from this fund of funds that David talked about. And I said, well, the primary reason is we're not a venture capital fund. We're just a bunch of consultants, guys running around having coffee, that kind of thing. And he said, and charging everybody for it. Yeah, that's right. It was a model that was working. So, he said, I think you need to, he gave me a stack of papers like this and said, I think you need to fill this out and try for some of this money. And I said, well, I just am not optimistic. This is not our line, but I'll take a look at it. So he said, okay, I need it Friday, and this was Wednesday. And, you know, we hadn't even thought about getting in this. And he said, well, I'll give you it. I complained, so he said, I'll give you till Monday. So we worked on it over the weekend, sent it in. Like 2 days later, he came back, and he said, everything looked really good, except we couldn't accept it because you have no venture capital experience. And I said, Mike, that's what I told you when you walked in the first time. And he said, but I've got some people I can partner you up with that have venture capital experience, and then we'll reconsider. So that started this parade of unemployed venture capitalists coming through, meeting with us, and we didn't really connect with any of those people. We met three different sets of people, and the fourth one we really liked, and they became partners in our venture fund. So we found these people we liked. We resubmitted our application. We got some money. And I don't know, a few days later, they said, you know, you got approved. We're going to be sending you X number of dollars to get started. And we literally were like the dog that caught the bus. We thought, you know, now we're in the venture capital business. We really don't know anything about it. And I had the good fortune of, probably through David's work, meeting Art. And Art and I chatted a little bit. He had this compound from Lilly that I thought, well, the bloodlines are good anyway. I couldn't understand anything. I'm a psychology major, so the science is really difficult for me. But Art's group had vetted this pretty well, and it seemed pretty exciting. And so we thought, well, let's take a chance on that. We'll make that our first investment. We'll invest with Art. And Art had he brought a couple other venture guys along at the same time, and all of a sudden we had some money to get started. And since then, I've just kind of hung on to Art's coattails the whole time and let him drag me along. So it's worked out pretty well.
And then you were fully launched at that point as a VC, and you made some other investments, obviously, as well.
We did. Yeah, we ended up, I think we made seven in total. One of them we put a significant amount of money in that didn't make it. One we put a very small amount of money just to kind of stay at the table. And that one didn't make it. And the other ones have all worked out okay. So, in fact, they've done well. But Calusa,
which is a pretty fine record,
John. Made our funds. So we have one left. I don't want to advertise it here, but we do have one left, an oncology company called Apexian that I think is going to also, you ask if this ever happen again.
I think what's the name of it?
Apexian.
We have high hopes for that company.
Yeah. Accepting angel money right now, actually. So, yeah. But anyway, I'll shut up.
And John, one other question for you, though, on this before I turn to Art. You obviously, you signed on early. You were in this all the way through and into the end. And, you know, this is not an easy process. And I know you know that firsthand. From your vantage point, what led to the ultimate success of this company?
Well, a couple things. And, you know, one thing you pointed out, the recession just killed us. I mean, it killed all the venture guys at that time. It really started like 2007, and you know, we started our company in
2005.
So I mean, it was hard to raise money, it was hard to sell companies, mm-hmm. and that went on until 2011 effectively. But we had great support. We had some, I think the fact that Art was so committed to this thing, we had an excellent CEO to get us started, to get out of the blocks, had a little experience. He had health problems eventually, had to be, he couldn't work anymore. Art was compassionate enough, he didn't want to replace him. So Art stepped in and was the CEO for a year and a half, something like that. And then we had the good fortune of finding Tom, Art and some of the other guys did. And Tom was just a godsend. He's one of those exceptional CEOs that I'm convinced he can make any company a success.
But he was
very helpful. And then, quite honestly, within our own environment, that was for Collusive, but for Pearl Street overall, we had 12 or 15 other people invest in Pearl Street in addition to this money we got from the fund of funds. And all those people invested in other companies as well. And some of them invested in our portfolio companies as well as through Pearl Street. They invested directly. Many of them got on the board of some of our portfolio mm-hmm. companies. And BioCrossroads invested with us on three different of our portfolio companies. So
yeah, and John, there's a real shout out for you there, because you know what you have done. When this all started, there was no angel investment community. There were really no individuals here participating at all. There are now a lot. And in part, really, that started with you and with the colleagues that you brought together, and it's expanded from there. So you made a big contribution to that.
Appreciate it.
So Art, you were the guy. You were the guy that really got caught the bus on this. And I know, and I remember talking to Mike Arpey about how this might come together, and I know that was very important. Intentionality matters throughout this entire process. So having a manager of the Indiana Future Fund who said, we'd really like to have a big deal done in Indiana, and then having you with that kind of experience saying, I'd really like to do one, mm-hmm. and I'm going to make it happen, and I'm going to bring some other colleagues along. We watched you and your team working out of our offices in multiple meetings with Lilly for a year leading up to this deal. So no aspect of this took place overnight. But once you finally had the company, I think it's fair to say you ended up, I don't think you were planning on doing phase three clinical trials, for example, when you started. Tell the story from your vantage point and sort of what this was like, because it seemed to me it was existential for you at many stages of the process.
Sure. So first of all, thank you for giving this opportunity to all of us. You are right. I hadn't thought about it. It's the first time we've sat together to really talk about the whole story and how it all played out. And there are so many historical crossovers here and relationships here. It's unbelievable if you think about it. So Pappas, it's now called Pappas Capital, and we manage just under $550 million, and we're investing out of our fifth fund now, and the Indiana Futures Fund was an investor in Fund 3, which is the one that Collusive was part of. And in our investment strategy, we are mostly in therapeutics. We do early stage, and a third of our capital goes out on the West Coast, a third goes up in the Northeast, and we have an intentional underserved market strategy that runs from Florida up to Quebec. And we're based in Research Triangle Park, as David said. We also have a specialized fund management group that does single LP relationships in early stage opportunities, and we have another unit that does translational medicine types of initiatives that at the university level is to bring things forward kind of pre-venture and move those forward. So we get in very early in terms of our activities. David was kind enough to make it sound like the license with Lilly took 90 days.
It took a while.
So, to put that in perspective, so our underserved market strategy is what caught the attention of Credit Suisse. Credit Suisse had been doing due diligence on another client for Credit Suisse and liked our strategy, liked our underserved area. We were still considered kind of this emerging manager in that regard. And as they were looking at it, we were asked also to look at the RFP for it. I'm amazed you could do it over a weekend. I think it took us 30 days to complete the RFP. But we put it on the back burner. And I'll come back to why. But when we were getting ready to raise the money for Collusive, or identifying Collusive, again, serendipity came into play, because Jim White, who was the ex-Lilly person, and I were sitting, this is 2 years before Calusi was even thought about. We were sitting on a board of a company up in Boston where Jim had left Lilly and gone up there to become the president, and he and I were on the same board. And Jim was telling me about the deprioritization that Darren was describing that was going on at Lilly. He said, you know, you come out of the CNS area, meaning my background was at Glaxo, I'd worked in the migraine area, you might be interested in some of the compounds that they may be deprioritizing. This was 2 years before we even started the process. So in our investment strategy, we start two companies per fund from scratch. And all of them come out of large pharma. And it's this deprioritization that we take advantage of. And all four of them have been great successes. Mm-hmm. And only one has been bought back, which is this, but they're all in that kind of mode to be bought back if necessary. And in all cases, they have been acquired by a pharma company in one form or another. So we made a seed investment. So the fund started in the end of 2004. IFF came in early 2005. Calucid was our fourth investment in the fund. And we seeded that company just to get it started in the summer of 2005, and ultimately we made the big investment in January of 2006. But it took us 2 years in identifying the compound from the deprioritization to bring it through the process. Three managers from Lilly. Darren broke the logjam toward the end to finally get this thing sorted out. We negotiated the license. Then it took us another 6 to 9 months to raise, almost 6 months to raise the Series A. For us, the Indiana Future Fund was a really strong element in what ultimately became an endorsing part of our underserved market strategy. And David, you and your team were just great to work with. Mike Arpey was the driver, but I will tell you the reason IFF didn't come into the very beginning of the fund when we started anchoring it down is there was a requirement that had us put the money back into the state. So every dollar that was going to be invested by IFF had to come back into the state. We had already sold our investment strategy to other investors that had committed to the fund, and we said, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. We just can't make that requirement. Thank you very much. So we turned it down. We turned it down twice, in fact, even though we had gone through the review process. And finally, we broke that logjam because you saw that we were dedicated to this part of our strategy. And I think Darren may have had something to do with that. Sean Wishmeyer, who was at Indiana Pensions, yeah, also excellently had, yeah, something to do with that. And all these, and David, you had a lot to do with that. So it all kind of came together in a way that made sense. But the investment thesis around lasmiditan, we didn't even have the name at the time, was that we could take this IV, very safe compound, from a pharmaceutical basis, elegant compound, that would give us great margins. We could make it into a tablet form, small molecule, and the market was going to be such that the migraine, which, as you said, there hadn't been a new compound for decades. The last one was the Glaxo compound. The triptans had going to become genericized. We saw an opportunity to bring this compound into the market and let it be used in primary care. And, oh, by the way, the Glaxos or the Lillies would buy it out post phase 2A or phase 2B. That was the thesis. Mm-hmm. What we underestimated was the shift in the market away from primary care by the pharma companies. And therefore, if you were going to sell something back to pharma, you have to be in phase 3. And Tom will tell you the story about what made us be able to do a phase 3, because it was not, you couldn't raise venture money and succeed by doing the old types of clinical trials. But we called the thesis wrong. And that was because it took us a long time to deal with the drug. As elegant as the compound was, we had classic metabolite problems, we had setbacks, we had the Jim White setback. The year and a half that I was involved, I probably didn't accelerate things much. But it was a variety of different things that caused us to have to do the.
But the market changed on you in that.
The market changed on us in a big way.
Right.
But to the point you made earlier, David, you do need kind of a dedication behind this because there were a lot of naysayers around this compound. And do you really want to do a phase three? And our team with the investors really, and with Lilly's input, Lilly monitored us through this whole process. And that was very valuable to us as we went through the process. The compound is a pharmaceutically elegant compound that's got great margins, had terrific intellectual property. And we were able to keep going with Tom's leadership, bring it forward.
And do you think that this is, again, a story that can be repeated?
Well, we count on it. We've done, like I said, three others besides Colucid. We're in the process of doing it'll probably be two or three more that we're going to end up doing in that regard. We like to build because we believe that if there's an unmet medical need and we can find a first-in-class or best-in-class compound, that using the external approaches to a pharma company standards, we can do this with the teams we can put together more effectively, more efficiently, and therefore, from a capital efficiency basis, better, we think.
But it still would not take place overnight, right?
It does not take place overnight. All of our programs have ranged. The longest has been Colucid, which is, in our books, a 12-year history. And to maybe the shortest has been 6 or 7 years.
Dedication.
Phase three takes a long time.
Yeah, dedication and intentionality. And again, for the audience, Art, you might want to just, and then I'm going to turn to Tom, but you might want to describe what phase three is just to give people a
sense of that. Phase one is a safety trial where most of the college kids around here probably enrolled in phase three trials. It's all healthy, young, human beings to make sure the drug is safe. And then the phase two is a safety, further safety, and an efficacy trial, so you're in patients. Phase three, you need two of them. They're large trials, all in patients. You need two successful trials to ultimately file for the NDA, which I think is where you're at right now.
And so phase three is long, expensive.
That's right.
Involves lots of people. And the FDA, again, sort of tells
that story because it was a real coup that occurred under Tom's leadership.
All right. Well, let's turn to Tom. So, Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
Delighted to meet you and have you here today to really round out this story. When did you enter this scene? When did you come on board, and where was Colucid when you came on board?
Well, thank you very much, David. And first of all, we've heard from a Rhodes Scholar. We've heard from a lawyer, two finance guys, so now I'll tell you the real story. So I have never been on stage with a Rhodes Scholar before, so it's an incredible honor. So I was contacted by a mutual friend of ours in 2011 to get involved with Colucid because the founding CEO, the late Dr. Jim White, had undergone some health issues, which ultimately he succumbed to a year or so later, and I got involved as a consultant to the company. I'm a serial entrepreneur in the biotech space. I live in the Boston area where access to capital and ideas is overwhelming. And I got involved with the company as a consultant 25% of my time and really came into this with really no bias and evaluated the project along with Art and the other directors in the company and came to the realization that in my mind, in order to take the company forward, I got involved in phase two, so kind of proof of concept, if you will, where you've moved out of healthy volunteers and safety and now you're into patients and you're really trying to evaluate does the drug work, at what dose level does the drug work, and what side effects do you see, and using that information, you then design your confirmatory studies in phase three. But it was clear to me that migraine was a tired old area. How many people in here either suffer from migraine or know somebody that suffers from migraine? Raise your hand, right? So 36 million Americans suffer from migraine today. And migraine's not just a headache. It's a symptom complex that involves sensitivity to light. Thank God I don't have migraine here today because the lights are bright. Sensitivity to sound. and nausea. And if you think about your friends and family who have migraine when they're in an attack, they all follow the same thing. The pattern, that is. They go into a room, they turn off the lights, they yell at the kids to shut up, and they turn off the stereo, and they lay down, and they just hope to God they're not going to throw up until this attack ends. And it can be anywhere from a few hours to a few days. And most migraine patients will suffer multiple attacks throughout a month. So it's incredibly debilitating. They can't work. They can't maintain their role as a parent, as a spouse. So it's really an enormous drag on our society and our economy. And the way migraine's been treated is to intervene at the time of the attack and try to shunt the symptoms and return people to normal function as fast as possible. So lasmiditan was described, beautiful molecule, totally new way of treating migraines. It works in the brain, whereas most medicines that have been approved to this date work in the periphery and actually squeeze down your blood vessels throughout your body to treat a migraine, which seems weird that we treat something central in the periphery by squeezing down your blood vessels. But it was at this point that I saw a real opportunity that we were kind of ducking the punch in the main question, which is, if we could treat migraine and do it in patients where squeezing down blood vessels is a bad idea, people like me who probably eat too many Cheetos or others who have cardiovascular risk or coronary disease, that would be a good idea. And let's not try to treat everyone. You know, 25-year-old females with migraine probably don't have cardiovascular risk, but there's a large segment. Women over 40 make up almost 8 out of 10 of all migraine patients in our country, you know, and they have a lot of cardiovascular risk over 40. So let's address that question head on. Are we better than conventional medicines, and can we study lasmiditan in a patient population that's most likely to take the drug? So it was with that I went back to the board and said, the development plan that's been laid out is based on legacy. Two big phase 3 trials. We're talking thousands and thousands of patients with very insensitive endpoints to measure success or not. To get a drug that would be given to everyone as panacea is probably not a good idea in today's reimbursement environment, the drive away from primary care, et cetera. And that was really the breakthrough we had as a board to say, let's stop what we're doing, guys. Let's reevaluate the regulatory pathway forward, and let's define what this drug should look like in the patients it should serve once it achieves market status, and then design our phase 3 trials. And that really involved going back to the FDA and revisiting how these trials are being conducted.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Please.
Because what was happening at the same time is we had Botox and the ergotamines being approved for acute migraine. So you had an interesting medical environment occurring with terrible drugs for dealing with something.
Absolutely.
That,
you know. Absolutely. So we actually slowed down the company. The company was out of money. But I wasn't worried because I knew we had strong investors who, if we had the right plan and team around the table, we could drive this forward. And we went to the FDA, and we utilized a process called special protocol assessment, which is where you actually present to the FDA your ideas for phase 3 development, the actual clinical protocol, and then you debate either new endpoints where you can measure success, new statistical methods where you evaluate how these endpoints are measured, and really to define a new paradigm in this type of drug development. And it was tough. We went to the FDA 4 times in a face-to-face battle. It was myself and our head of clinical and regulatory across the table from the division director at the FDA, and we had a major disagreement, a polite but a major disagreement. And we then accessed what's called the formal dispute resolution pathway, where we brought in a guy named Bob Temple, who is extremely senior at FDA, really to be the arbiter of this disagreement. And we wound up having a breakthrough in which we actually were able to redefine novel endpoints to measure success in our phase 3 trial. We allowed the inclusion of pretty sick patients, patients who had a lot of cardiovascular risk, who in previous trials had all been excluded because the drugs on the market were deemed too dangerous in these patient populations. But we wanted to put them into our trial because those are the people who we ultimately saw best to serve once the drug is approved. And that special protocol agreement and the clinical regulatory science that we undertook really at the expense of moving the program forward over the course of about 18 months while we negotiated this, really led to the breakthrough for the company.
And
probably answer like five questions.
No, that's so and so you had that. Did what besides observing that things need to move more quickly? Did you have a playbook for doing that? I mean, had you seen that done with other companies before? How did you know how to go about that? Because it sounds pretty hard.
So it's my experience being coming out of the my kind of bones were made at a company called Genzyme, which early days we focused on. A rare disease called Gaucher disease in patients because of a monogenetic disorder do not make glucocerebrosidase, which is an important enzyme in processing in metabolism in children, and they wind up dying at the age of 12. We originally were collecting fresh placentas from birthing centers and doing protein purification to get glucocerebrosidase. This is before the days of recombinant protein production. We then went into mammalian cells and were able to produce glucocerebrosidase at industrial scale, so no longer were we collecting placentas, if you can imagine. But that patient population was 3,000 patients in the world. It was a $1 billion drug back in the 90s, just to give you some sense of scale. But life-saving therapy for children. So from that perspective, I always started from a very narrow patient population, whereas pharma looks for the broadest population because they are an industrial machine. Nobody sells and markets and gets reimbursement better than pharma, but they're looking at large markets. But for me, going from a 3,000-patient worldwide market opportunity to migraine, where you're talking millions and millions and millions worldwide, you know, what slice of that pie is most applicable for our drug? That's the lens that I use in evaluating this opportunity. So did I have experience going to FDA and arm wrestling over special protocol agreements? Absolutely not. But it seemed to me it was logical, and I learned very early days in my career, anytime you get a chance to go talk to the FDA, you take it. So as a senior executive, I was at FDA a lot, not only at Colusa, but in previous companies, a lot face-to-face because they make it happen. Mm-hmm. And most investors will tell you one of the greatest impediments in investment in the life science space and new therapeutic developments is regulatory risk. If you had a clear vision, a clear horizon on regulatory risk and regulatory science, it would make our investment decisions much easier. So
I have to add, because from an investor perspective, when Tom was doing the consulting, we had a problem. We had feedback from the pharma industry that they weren't going to buy this until we gave them clearer data. And we also knew that we weren't going to be able to raise the money to do a traditional migraine trial. Mm-hmm. So Tom had the leadership abilities and the skills to problem solve that for us. And that's what he did in the early days of the consulting that made us comfortable in a way by getting the special protocol assessment to rally the investors to move forward.
And so this then led to your, is it Samurai trial that you did?
That's right.
And trials by that point were being done in the Boston Cambridge area. I think even Jim White had started some of that. But somewhere in all this, we're around 2015 now, the company goes public.
That's right.
Not easy either. And again, over the life of this development, again, when we started all this, if a company went public, it meant it was exiting, and it meant it was about to become a full-fledged company. For you folks, a company going public was a way to get more money.
It's a
financing event. So whole different deal.
Yeah, so it was a crazy sequence of events. So first of all, I always believe in naming phase three clinical trials after great warriors. So we had three phase three clinical trials, Samurai, Spartan, and Gladiator. And there was a fourth clinical trial, which hopefully Lilly will undertake, called Ranger. So fantastic warriors, and it resonates with investors, believe it or not. So once we got clarity from the FDA, I became a full-time employee, and we actually did what's called a mezzanine financing round, which really sets the stage to provide enough capital to get Samurai underway and pay for it. But also sets a stage where you bring in investors who not only invest privately, but also can follow the investment into public markets. And so in January of 2015, we closed just under a $40 million private financing round. We brought in some new investors to include TVM Capital, Novo Ventures, Auriga, and some others. But our previous investors all followed us faithfully and turned out to be a great decision for them. And we immediately turned around, and I had at this time now 4 employees, and I filed to go public confidentially. And we went out and started to tell the story to public investors in what's called a confidential marketing period. And it was clear that we were getting some traction, but the markets were very choppy at that time. But in May 2015, we were able to complete a $55 million IPO. So we raised, within a period of 6 months, just under $100 million, which were funds that were suitable to fund both Samurai and Spartan through completion, but not get us all the way through to an approval. So we clearly had to have some success along the way, or the company was dead. Because you have Spartan or Samurai read out. If it was negative, I might still have $30 million in the bank, but nobody's going to want to invest in migraine lasmiditan anymore. We were a single asset company. And oh, by the way, we had other stuff in the pantry, but we wound up having to scuttle those programs to devote all our assets to lasmiditan's ultimate success. But that was a crazy time going through the IPO. The stock IPO'd at $10. That's great. All right, we're out. We got our $55 million. But because we only sold the stock to like 12 people, 12 major funds, and everyone's sitting on it waiting for the river card coming when Samurai trial was going to be announced a year later, you had very few shares trading on a daily basis. So my stock went all the way down. Our stock went all the way down to $3.80. And now I'm fielding calls from people like you who know our investor relation line and say, I want to talk to Mathers and find out why my $10 stock's at $3.80. So those were tough times, and as a CEO, you spend just as much time not only driving the strategy and making sure your team's on track, but also talking to your investors and telling them to keep the faith. And ultimately, it turned out to be a good strategy for them.
So some of us here, and I know Lily was tracking these developments, but some of us here sort of had lost track almost of Colucid by this point. This is now we're in 2016.
That's right.
And it's the day after Labor Day, and I get an email from Art. And Art and I have stayed in constant contact, but I haven't gotten an email like this from Art ever. And it said, we're having an investor call on Colucid this morning. You should be on it. And that's where you came in. And although I had not met you at the time, I had never heard, I think, Tom, the word was giddy. I mean, you were excited. Because you had something that had separated, I think, 50% or more from placebo. And clearly, the results you got were surprising a little bit even to you, I think, at that point. What happened at that point?
Dave, what are you talking about? I think, you know, first of all, I'll tell a fun story because some of you are still in college. But on August 25th, I had a board meeting. And I know the date because it's my daughter's birthday. And we were in Cambridge, and I'm waiting at the board dinner to disclose the results of the Samurai trial to the board confidentially. And it's now, I was supposed to have them that morning. They don't come all day. The statisticians won't release the data to us. And now we've gone through the board dinner. My clinician is at home furiously working the phones with the statistician. The board dinner's wrapping up, and now it's just our board and myself. And she texts me with the top line results. And so for the younger folks in here, just some career advice, never order many bottles of champagne and bourbon after 10 o'clock at night, no matter what the celebration, because it made for a long day the next day. And our website pictures, which we took the next morning of the entire board, have since been deleted because I don't want to be seen as sunglasses. But in any event, after Labor Day, just a week or two later, we did hold a press conference, and we were fully transparent with all the results of Samurai. They were overwhelmingly positive, and we were tickled pink. We had taken a lot of risk with new endpoints with the FDA. Those proved to be incredibly sensitive measures in the terms of treating migraine. It really changed the science. And by the way, if you go to develop a drug in this area now, the playbook that the FDA puts out, which is called guidance, the guidance basically says, do it the way Colucid did. So it's really vindicating and validating for us. But at that time, our stock had been around $8 going into that morning session. It immediately went to $20. And we announced the results. Immediately following that press conference, my phone was ringing. I got calls from six or seven pharmaceutical companies saying, "Hello, how are you, gorgeous?" So, Darren didn't. I wish it had been Darren, but it was. It was Rob Conley from Lilly who made that call and just said, "You're about to be descended upon by an army of Lilly people. We really like the work that you did." And so that's really exciting, but because the capital markets had gone from 8 to 20 and we knew we needed to raise more money, we decided to access those capital markets. And so this is where as an entrepreneur and as a CEO, you always get a little bit of a wrangling with your shareholders because, you know, Art owns a big piece of the company at this point, and now I'm going to bring in a lot more money, which means his portion gets diluted. So we started arm wrestling over how much money to raise or even to raise money. And Art was trying to keep me at $30 million. But we wound up raising $75 million after Art finally saw the wisdom in that. And we had over $500 million of demand on the books. So we sold stock overnight at $20 a share, $75 million worth of new stock at $20 a share. And the stock went to almost $30 because there had been so much demand. People started piling in. And so at that point, we started a process dancing with not only Lilly, but multiple parties who were interested in the program. But we now had enough cash on the table to develop this drug all the way through approval. So we had options.
So let's, and we're going to open this up for questions in just a moment, but let's round this out with the two of you, because you and Darren were then speaking with each other, I'm sure, on a pretty regular basis. Our phones were all ringing here, too, because we all of a sudden had an Indiana Future Fund that was definitely going to be well in the money, and we were pretty happy about it. So you begin, obviously, you're deciding you're going to sell and you're going to do something with the company. Lilly is a logical place to look for that. Tom, from your perspective, how did the deal get done? And I'm going to ask Darren the same thing.
It's hard because we're a seven-person company. It's clear that we can't take it all the way through approval as a seven-person company. So we now have to heavily invest, bringing people and facilities up online. So at this point for our board and for our shareholders, we thought it made sense to do a transaction with a strategic partner, whether it was Lilly or somebody else. They just have the whole chassis already in place to strap on something like this and take it across the finish line. It was stressful. We ran a process with bankers, and as a public company, my responsibility is to get the most money I can for every share outstanding for our shareholders. And it's Darren's job as a responsible corporate executive to buy the best assets in at the right price that makes sense for them. So it's stressful, to say the least.
But we had enough money on the balance sheet that we could go our own if we needed to, or at least raise additional money. It was attractive.
So that was an alternative. You could have gone back into the market.
Not the ideal, but it was an alternative.
Okay.
From our perspective, so we had actually been following the molecule the whole time. First, it was intensely followed both by the business development group, which I lead, and other colleagues within Lilly Research Labs. But as a number of those folks retired, what we found was that the folks who remained at Lilly who were following the company closely were all within the business development group, because, candidly, our necks were in the noose on this one, that we had sort of told the company this was going to be a great deal, look how it's going to work, and someone had to monitor it pretty closely. So we were monitoring it closely. Rob Conley, who Tom mentioned, is one of the top clinical leaders in our company in the central nervous system area. He takes over in late-stage development for compounds. And when the data hit, I had actually called Rob and a few of the other colleagues together and said, how do you like whiskey? And it's an odd question to ask at 10 o'clock in the morning. But I'll answer it. You know, it seemed fine to me. I said, great. Well, the pain meeting, the international pain meeting, is going to be in Scotland, and you're going to be there, and you're going to meet with these guys. And that was the start of the en masse. We could see that this was such an attractive molecule, not just to us. We knew that there were other competitors that would want this molecule. And so we decided, frankly, to try to jump the process. This is all public, so this has all been publicly disclosed, but we decided to jump the process, and we sent Tom an unsolicited offer to buy the company with a pretty significant premium. The very next day, which we know as the day after we made the offer for Lastminute.tan, but as some of you will know as the day of the United States presidential election, the entire premium, pretty much, I think, that we made in the offer got erased because the biotech market had such a big run-up after the presidential election. So we saw an offer that we thought was actually, we thought a compelling enough offer to get things at least going, if not to buy the company. All of a sudden we thought, like, you know, hey, we got a great offer here. We looked at the market again and we thought, well, actually, maybe not so much. And so there was a very intense process that was really run through the holidays, really, through the Christmas holidays, where we were told, you know, look, you got to basically be on your mark and ready to go on the first business day of the year and get us a revised offer as part of a formal process. And so we actually ran the deal not only sort of over the holidays internally, which, you know, it's candidly in the deal world, it's actually never hard when you've got an exciting piece of science that could really make a difference in the lives of millions of people. It's really not hard to get people to work all the way through. I count on that, quite frankly. So for me to do my job, I count on people just kind of cranking through based on their excitement about it. And they were. And so we were ready to go as part of a bigger process involving others. We ended up doing the deal, really, through the J.P. Morgan conference. Their banker picked the busiest time of, like, literally the entire, you couldn't pick five busier days in the entire year to do it. And we ran essentially the entire process doing that, going back and forth a few times during the J.P. Morgan week. So we at Lilly were, on our side, we're literally running people around the clock, kept people back here, pulled people out of J.P. Morgan so they could stay here and we could work around the clock in 24-hour shifts, working on J.P. Morgan and this deal back and forth. And it was the only way, frankly, we wanted to maintain that pace because we thought we were in a good position. We wanted to make sure we didn't lose it.
Right.
Because it was also, for us, it was a great homecoming story. It's sort of the prodigal molecule, right? It's a molecule that left our labs sort of, you know, with our fond wishes and went off on a journey, right? This molecule went off on a decade-long journey in the hands of some very able investors and obviously led by Tom, some very able drug developers, right? But this is a molecule that was coming back as sort of a full grown-up, if you will, right? Maybe left as a toddler, so to speak, came back as a full grown-up. And we're going to have to be prepared then as well, once we bought it, to actually own it, right? So this is also where you don't want to catch the bus either as a buyer. You got to be ready to buy it and own it at that point. And that's where things closed down. So we actually had very intense, good arm's length conversations. The only person I couldn't speak actually was with this guy, because since Lilly was actually an investor in the Indiana Future Fund, we were deemed to have a conflict with him.
And
we also were an investor with
yeah.
TVM.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Art was the chair of the board. TVM, another fund that came in that Mez round, had gotten a big investment from us. And so the two people who we thought, I normally call board members all the time when we go to do a deal. It's just part of the standard package. Art and I had been trading Christmas cards for over a decade. I actually was saying to Art the other day, I went to my lawyers and got my Christmas card reviewed and said, can I say anything to him?
That's insane.
And I said, you know, what's printed on the card? And I said, well, fortunately, it's nothing that says I wish you prosperity.
Had you paid more?
So meanwhile, in all this, of course, what Bob Crossroads wanted out of this deal was just to be able to celebrate it, talk about it, have stories out about it, and nobody would talk to us. And in fact, we didn't even know you guys were in negotiations until, I mean, Darren's our board chair. Darren wouldn't talk to us. And then we kind of started to figure some things out. So that's been another reason that it's taken a while to get the story out until now, because we had to get completely through the transaction.
Right.
But we're here. And so we've got a few minutes left here for questions from you. Those of us sitting up here have a little trouble seeing in the audience, but if you raise your hand, we can find you. So who has a question?
Hello. Hello?
There you go.
Oops, okay. Hello, I'm Yannick Pandelidis. I would like to ask Mr. Matthews about you mentioned about regulatory risk. And clearly, in all aspects, the issue of assessment of risk, whether scientific, IP risk, and regulatory risk is important. For you, is there something that could have been done by the FDA or something else to assess, to mitigate the risk for you, the assessment of risk, regulatory risk, for instance?
So I think that it's a great question, and thank you for that. I think that when I speak broadly about regulatory risk, when you think about developing a new drug for diabetes, for example, we all know that's a massive health problem, and merging is an even bigger problem. But for a company, as myself as an entrepreneur, as I think about getting into a new treatment for diabetes, it's overwhelming when you think about what the requirements are going to be from regulatory agencies around the world to monitor cardiovascular risk and outcomes, et cetera, just to treat somebody's type 2 diabetes. And as such, it almost seems like a bridge too far, and therefore I will most likely go into other areas. Same with investors. When they think about making bets, and you don't know what an agency is going to require for a company in a later stage to assess risk in this certain program before they approve it, it just becomes very intractable as an investment thesis, if you will, to pursue, and therefore money flows other places. In migraine, I'm not sure that they could have done anything beforehand because the system really had not been pushed until we got there. I think my experience with FDA is once we started those negotiations, they negotiated in good faith. Like I said, we had a very respectful disagreement. We were able to solve that disagreement, and I think it's pretty clear now. So it's now there's a lot of investment in migraine, as you'll see.
Other questions?
Tom, one of the strengths of Central Indiana is its contract research and manufacturing strengths. 7,000-8,000 people in the region do that, a lot of because it became Lilly's supplier network before you would do things in other regions or other countries. With 7 people as a public company, can you talk about how important those partners were? Because I think that's an underappreciated part of the story. When we talk with our media, when we talk with thought leaders, they're like, oh, well, you don't employ anybody, so you must not really be that important. Can you talk about how important those partners were? Because it had to have been just really level of comfort for you to put your operations in the hands of others.
So, you know, access to capital and then relationships and people are the things that are most important in this business. You've got to have good ideas and IP and regulatory clarity. All that's important. But for us, instead of investing in bricks and mortar to manufacture or do preclinical experiments, et cetera, we had a very broad network of trusted partners that we've worked with many, many times over. I unfortunately do not have a network of those types of partners within Indiana, since I've been based in Boston my entire career.
We can arrange for that, Sam.
We can arrange for it. But I would also say that what had not been known at least in my kind of young career, was kind of pilot scale things or smaller scale things. You know, most biotech companies are under 25 people. 80% of all biotech companies in our biotech universe are under 25 people. 90%+ of them are pre-revenue. So when you think about the types of experiments and the scale that we do, the biggest need is in some of the earlier stage things. When you're talking about massive API manufacturing plants in Indiana, they're looking for the big hits, things at later stage. So it's really more of the stage of relationship that I was in, more than anything within Indiana. I think that those relationships, though, are critical to the biotech ecosystem, having trusted partners, manufacturing or tox or pharmacology out there to access.
When we started the company, we used a lot of the service providers in the area. And John's group was an important group for us on due diligence and other types of support. But when we were trying to figure out the plan of moving this IV component into a small molecule component, we used a network around the United States, but we did use some service providers here. In fact, I'll give you another example that doesn't get talked a lot about, but one of our other companies that we invested in is a company called Plexicon, which is an oncology company in melanoma around the BRAF inhibitor. The combination of finding that biomarker occurred here in Indiana with Roche Diagnostics.
It was what drove the development of the actual molecule that ultimately Roche picked up for U.S. and Europe, and we ultimately sold the company to Daiichi Sankyo for a little bit over $1 billion. But we wouldn't have done that without what happened here through the diagnostic program that Roche had.
Other questions?
I would just personally, as a chronic migraine sufferer, say thank you to all of you on this stage for what you're doing. A couple questions. So how long now between phase three to market does this take? And also, as you said, now there seems to be much more investment in this area. Why now? Why now, after all of these years there haven't been new drugs on the market, is this now becoming such an attractive market?
I'll answer the second question quickly, and that is regulatory certainty. We now have new guidance, I think, thanks to the work of my team, having gone to FDA and driving through new guidance not only into acute treatment of migraine, but chronic migraine. So with regards to the timing to market?
So when we bought Colucid, it had one positive phase three trial, and then we had to wait several months, I guess
August
five,
of this
four,
year.
Four or five months, roughly, for the next trial. That was a nervous time, I'll be frank, right, because if you ever want to look like a really unhappy business development lead, spend $1 billion on a company and see the second trial turn out negative. Fortunately, that didn't happen. The second trial was very confirmatory. So typically you're looking at roughly a year or so. So we'll be looking to go to market with that. So lasmiditan is a treatment for people who are suffering from a migraine, but there's also a lot of innovation in the area of prophylactics for migraine. And the reason why that's moved forward, actually, is also because of the science, right? So the science around what's called a CGRP, calcitonin G-coupled protein receptor science, that science started about 32 years ago. How can I be so sure? Because actually we have one of those. And it's a molecule that we actually sent out. It was another deprioritized molecule. We actually put it in the hands of another group of venture capitalists in a company called Arteus, and they developed that molecule and brought it back in. The other reason I can be so certain about that is that by pure coincidence, the president of Lilly Research Labs, our top scientist around the world, is widely considered to be one of the fathers of this area of science. He worked on in his lab as a young scientist at the Karolinska Institute. Gives you a sense of the long arcs here, right? I mean, 30 years from some of the initial findings to the times when we were actually going to be able to get a drug. But there's now going to be several medicines, we hope, knock on wood, in the market because we're actually generating positive results in that area of science as well. So we're going to go to market, we hope, depending on how things work out with the regulators, of course. With several medicines, one to prevent some migraines. That won't work in all patients, unfortunately, but it does work in quite a few. And then to treat patients who are suffering either migraines that break through or for whom those preventatives didn't work. This is, as Tom said, it's a major area of unmet medical need, and people didn't maybe appreciate it in part because we didn't have great options, right? And so doctors have basically one set of options to offer to patients. But when new options become available, we also start to get a better understanding as to how much suffering there is. And there is a tremendous amount, as you mentioned yourself.
And I think with that, we are unfortunately at our time. So thank all of you for coming today. We, in the new year, will have another framework session on diabetes on January 23rd at the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, following up with another one in February on data analytics. But we're just delighted to have had this discussion here today and to get this story told by the people who lived it and made it happen. Please join me in thanking our panel.